welcome to the Legg Mason Fiscal Second Quarter 2017 Earnings Call. My name is John, and I'll be your operator for today's teleconference. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. A brief question-and-answer session will follow the formal presentation. If anyone should require operator assistance during the teleconference, please press star then zero on your touch-tone phone. Please note that this teleconference is being recorded. It is now my pleasure to introduce your host, Alan Magleby, Head of Investor Relations and Corporate Communications. Thank you, Mr. Magleby. You may begin.
Thank you. On behalf of Legg Mason, I would like to welcome you to our conference call to discuss operating results for the fiscal 2017 second quarter ended September 30, 2016. This presentation may contain forward-looking statements within the meaning of the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act of 1995. These forward-looking statements are not statements of facts or guarantees of future performance and are subject to risks, uncertainties, and other factors that may cause actual results to differ materially from those discussed in the statements. For a discussion of these risks and uncertainties, please see risk factors and management's discussion and analysis of financial condition and results of operations in the company's annual report on Form 10-K for the fiscal year ended March 31st, 2016, and in the company's subsequent filings with the Securities and Exchange Commission. During the call today, we may also discuss non-GAAP financial information. Reconciliations of the non-GAAP financial information to the comparable GAAP financial information can be found in the press release that we issued this morning, which is available in the Investor Relations section of our website. The company undertakes no obligation to update the information contained in this presentation to reflect subsequently occurring events or circumstances. This morning's call will include remarks from Mr. Joe Sullivan, Legg Mason's Chairman and CEO, and Mr. Pete Nakaway, Legg Mason's CFO, who will discuss our financial results. In addition, following a review of the company's quarter, we will then open the call to Q&A. Now I would like to turn this call over to Mr. Joe Sullivan. Joe?
Welcome, and thank you for joining us on our second fiscal quarter 2017 earnings call. We continue to operate in a challenging macro environment from the impact of global regulatory changes, including most recently the DOL fiduciary rule in the U.S., to the continued migration of investors to passive and its impact on fee rates, to the significant moves by investors from prime to U.S. and government liquidity funds as a result of money market reform, and the worst net flow quarter in U.S. active equities since 2008. Despite these pressures, Legg Mason delivered a solid second fiscal quarter while continuing to reposition the firm for success in a dramatically evolving industry. Our scale, diversification, and global reach are going to be increasingly important in this effort as we will be able to more effectively compete in this low rate, low growth, low fee, and more highly regulated environment. Against that backdrop, we have pursued our strategy of expanding choice for our global clients through diversification. That diversification encompasses asset classes and investment capabilities, products and vehicles, and distribution and client access across various channels and geographies. We have strengthened Legg Mason's competitive standing in each area, and we are a better company, offering more value and choice for our clients. To accomplish this dramatic repositioning, we've executed against an ambitious M&A agenda to diversify and strengthen our affiliate portfolio by addressing the three critical business areas that I just mentioned. We are very pleased with the investments we have made and how they factor into the future growth for Legg Mason. Our primary focus now is on organic growth, directing our resources to promoting our long-standing affiliates while commercializing the new investment capabilities that we've acquired into new products, vehicles, and solutions offerings across our global distribution platform. This will take time. but early evidence of success is seen in the $4.3 billion of inflow into QS investors in our sub-advisory business last year, and the over $250 million we were able to raise with Rare Infrastructure in the quarter in a retail UK fund just after the leave vote in June. We have launched products in the U.S. for both Martin Currie and Rare, and have specific new product initiatives underway with both Entrust Permal and Clarion Partners, and client reaction for both thus far is encouraging. To complement our focus on organic growth, we've also been mindful to maintain a strong balance sheet and ensure that capital is being deployed thoughtfully. We funded our most recent transactions by choosing to access the debt markets with very attractive, long-term capital. At the same time, we have approved consistent dividend increases and a disciplined share repurchase program that combined has seen us emerge as an industry leader in terms of the rate at which we return capital to shareholders. Now, I'd like to take a moment to share our thoughts about the impact of the DOL fiduciary rule on our industry and on Legg Mason. We believe that it is likely that the effect of the DOL rule will be broader than just on retirement accounts. Some firms may choose to follow comparable standards with respect to non-retirement accounts, and we expect the SEC to follow suit with its own fiduciary rule that will apply to the broader business. The DOL and other forthcoming regulations will have a similarly dramatic impact on our distribution partners, will change how the industry operates, and will likely put pressure on industry margins. To remain competitive, industry participants, including Legg Mason, will need to evaluate and modify their distribution approach just as our clients do. We also expect the new DOL rule to cause distribution platforms to consolidate their product lineups. Like most everyone, we do expect to lose some products and AUM on these platforms that haven't really gained traction or have underperformed. But at the same time, we see a great opportunity to become a net flow winner from these platform reallocations with, by some estimates, as much as $3 trillion of money being in motion. So I'd like to share five key reasons why we are well positioned to win in this new post-DOL world. Specifically, we have a deep roster of products well placed across the platforms of our distribution partners that have strong performance and investment objectives that solve retirement needs. Secondly, we have an ability to utilize our leading position in the SMA market, our multi-asset class capabilities, and our efforts to expand our retail investment capabilities in ETF vehicles to meet the needs of the retirement market. Third, we have a wide range of competitively priced investment vehicles and pricing structures, including I and IS shares that can be converted to meet fee level requirements. Fourth, we have a distribution sales team of more than 250 professionals who work with home offices and in the field with advisors at our partner firms as they adapt to this new environment. And finally, we now have a digital capability in Financial Guard through which our partner firms can leverage the technology to serve smaller portfolios efficiently and deliver solutions that meet the fiduciary standard. Again, scale and diversification matters even more in a post-DOL world. Now, let's take a quick run through the quarter. Slide 2 shows the highlights for the quarter. We reported net income of $66.4 million, or 63 cents per diluted share. We ended the quarter with assets under management of $733 billion, which included fixed income inflows of $2.8 billion, more than offset by alternative and equity outflows of $1.6 billion and $1.5 billion respectively. I'll discuss this in more detail, but we are very pleased with the continued momentum in global retail distribution. The platform drove gross sales of $19.5 billion and net sales of $3.9 billion, underscoring the diversity in our strategies, products, vehicles, and distribution. And finally, we retired 2.7 million shares during the quarter. Slide 3 shows the AUM and flows of our 9 affiliates. There are a couple of interesting themes playing out across our platform. First, there is a lot of money in motion broadly related to both distribution platforms and institutions reevaluating their needs. Investors seem to be moving more money more frequently within and between asset classes and different vehicles. We expect this trend to continue, which will likely lead to larger, episodic, and lumpy ins and outs. Also, as I mentioned during our investor call last month, I caution you about drawing definitive conclusions, positively or negatively, with respect to our monthly flow reporting. Secondly, and perhaps a bit counterintuitively, at a time when all we seem to hear about is the relentless investor move from active to passive strategies, our pipeline of opportunities, as distinct from unfunded wins, is strong. Our equity affiliates are reporting relatively high levels of search activity for larger institutional active mandates at Brandywine Global, ClearBridge, and Martin Currie. And we are also seeing strong search activity in fixed income with Western and in alternatives with Clarion, all of which is obviously very encouraging. Finally, while the shift to passive mandate continues to create headwinds, managers that offer next-generation active and classic active strategies with differentiated investment performance will likely grow through market share gains. So let's start with some specifics on slide 3 with Western Asset, which had a very nice quarter with $4.3 billion in net long-term flows and ended the period with $4.2 billion in unfunded wins. Not surprisingly, Western also experienced significant outflows from their prime money market fund products, reflecting in part industry trends in advance of the money market reform regulations, which have since taken effect. Investment performance at Western remains strong, and new client business drove much of the inflow, with more than half of their net inflow coming from new client accounts in the quarter. Investor interest remained broadly high across unconstrained, long-term credit, total return, and core plus strategies. Western is also seeing a similar move by institutional clients, like that with our retail distribution partners, to consolidate more assets with fewer managers. And we would expect such a trend to benefit large global managers like Western. Next, ClearBridge, which had $800 million in outflows in a very difficult environment for active equities. We are pleased that the rate of outflows slowed meaningfully in the quarter and are encouraged by their quarter-ending book of $2 billion in unfunded wins. And as I alluded to, search activity at ClearBridge is close to their highest level in the last 3 years. We are particularly excited about the growing interest in ESG strategies for ClearBridge, a space where the company has been active for almost 30 years. Investment performance at ClearBridge is generally strong versus peers, but a bit more challenged on a relative benchmark basis, as beating the indexes in highly rotational, momentum-driven markets can be quite difficult. Brandywine Global is near its all-time high with $69.5 billion in total AUM, despite a disappointing $2 billion in quarterly outflows. Brandywine ended the period with $400 million in quarter and unfunded wins and generally solid investment performance in an asset class with diminished investor expectations. With some $11 trillion in global bonds now exchanging hands at negative rates, and a global index with an approximately 65 basis point yield against an 8-year duration, the attractiveness broadly of global bonds as an asset class is challenged. However, we are pleased to see Brandywine's investment performance in the quarter improve, and like ClearBridge, pleased that they too are seeing a heightened level of search activity in large cap active equity strategies. Next, Clarion Partners, with $200 million of inflow in the quarter and $1.2 billion in committed but uncalled capital. Returns for core real estate, which have been quite strong, are beginning to normalize to levels more in line with the historical fundamentals of supply and demand, which are still favorable. Clarion and we view this reversion to more historical returns as a healthy phenomena, as it helps to manage client expectations around returns and diminishes the concerns about a capital-driven real estate bubble. While U.S. institutional investors are increasingly approaching target allocations for commercial real estate, foreign institutions and high net worth investors remain meaningfully underallocated. Certain exogenous factors should support the continued increase in demand for real estate, as the recent U.S. tax code revision, known as FRPTA, and S&P's and MSCI's decision to separate REITs from the financials sector elevate both the attractiveness and profile of U.S. commercial real estate. We view all three markets, U.S. institutional, non-U.S. institutional, and the ultra-high net worth and retail space, as meaningful growth opportunities for Clarion. Now, Royce, which closed our second quarter with $1.1 billion in outflows. From a market perspective, value continues to outperform growth year-to-date, which is ultimately good for Royce, even as growth outperformed during the recent quarter. The Royce team believes that the small-cap sector will remain strong and expects value to reassert its market leadership. Year-to-date, 83% of Royce assets beat their respective benchmarks, and new opportunities for Royce are beginning to tick up in new vehicles, including SMAs, CITs, and potentially ETFs. Entrust Permal experienced $2 billion in outflows, now has $700 million in unfunded wins, and ended the quarter with $1.8 billion in uncalled capital. Entrust Permal is rapidly evolving from a hedge fund-to-fund business to a broader alternatives business, as evidenced by the mix of their book, which was an important consideration of ours in partnering with them. The hedge fund business broadly is under the same pressure as more traditional active management, with hedge fund redemptions last quarter being the highest since 2009. The new Entrust Permal can now offer new and very differentiated sources of investment alpha for global institutional and retail clients through customized strategies, co-investment opportunities, and specialized products such as direct lending strategies. Rare Infrastructure, with inflows of $100 million, saw investment performance strengthen during the period. As I mentioned, we successfully launched a new UK fund with Rare at the beginning of the quarter, raising over $250 million US in a very volatile market following the Brexit vote. Interest in Rare's U.S. 40 Act fund is building, albeit slowly, as U.S. investors begin their journey with listed infrastructure investing. Next, QS Investors had outflows of $300 million, but ended the quarter with $100 million in unfunded wins. Outflows were in classic active strategies, again reflecting the consolidation at distribution platforms, which I discussed earlier, and a bit of a trend with some larger institutional clients who are bifurcating their active equity allocations between passive core equity and more highly concentrated strategies. Investment performance in ETF strategies managed by QS remains strong, and we continue to see a significant long-term opportunity with QS in developing asset allocation models for our distribution clients. And finally, we are very pleased to see Martin Currie have a strong quarter with $1.3 billion in net long-term flows in the quarter and $300 million in unfunded wins. We are having significant success in Asia with real asset and REIT products managed by Martin Currie Australia, with momentum building in Europe. Slide 4 shows the diversification of our AUM and revenues. Now, I realize that this is a busy slide, so we've highlighted the numbers that we believe are the most meaningful, the nice balance of revenue across asset classes. This is exactly the kind of business diversification that we have pursued over the past few years, and while we are working to continue to diversify our business, we're very pleased to be making significant progress. Now on to slide 5. With all the dislocation and disruption within our industry, I couldn't be more proud of how our global distribution team has performed in such a challenging environment. Our retail platform's results in the quarter were the best in over a year, with gross and net sales of $19.5 billion and $3.9 billion respectively, driven by core strength in the U.S. and Japanese retail markets. This again shows the importance of diversification by investment strategy, channel, and geography. Positive net sales were driven primarily by Western Asset and Martin Currie Australia, with net sales at Rare Infrastructure and Entrust Permal also positive. It is particularly rewarding to see the drivers of positive net sales in the quarter being such a nice blend of both longstanding and newer affiliates. Outflows in U.S. equity were consistent with industry trends, but the overall quarterly redemption rate on the platform dropped to 22%, favorable to industry averages. This kind of performance only reinforces our strong belief that large-scale managers, with the ability to offer a breadth of investment strategies across products and vehicle types through multiple channels, will gain share. For example, we're broadly experiencing market share gains in retail SMAs, and we believe there is more to be had. We're confident that we have the products, the performance, the strong shelf space placement, and the sizable client-facing infrastructure to support our distribution partners. This, in turn, positions Legg Mason to emerge as a winner as our clients embark on modifying their business approach and streamlining and consolidating their platforms in a post-DOL world. Slide 6 shows investment performance with solid performance across all time periods. And with that, let me turn it over to Pete.
Thanks, Joe. Let's turn to slide 7. As Joe noted, we generated earnings of $66 million, or 63 cents per diluted share. This quarter, our GAAP earnings per share included a number of offsetting items: acquisition and transition-related costs of $13 million, and a $4 million charge due to an interest rate swap termination cost related to our debt financing, were partially offset by a $7 million credit from a reduction in the fair value of the Rare contingent consideration liability, and $6 million of discrete tax credits, largely driven by a reduction in the UK corporate tax rate. Taken together, these items reduced earnings per share by a penny. Average long-term AUM increased to $632 billion, driven by improved markets, as well as a full quarter of Clarion and Entrust AUM. Our operating revenues increased $48 million from fiscal Q1, largely driven by higher pass-through performance fees at Clarion, as well as higher average AUM, one additional day in the quarter, and a full quarter of Entrust and Clarion revenues. In terms of performance fees, as I mentioned last quarter, we did not pay for performance fees on Clarion's legacy AUM, and thus any performance fees recognized by Clarion on that business will be passed through to Clarion's management team. This quarter, these fees totaled $36 million, which are also included in compensation expense. Ex Clarion's performance fees, our remaining performance fees totaled $6 million. And while impossible to predict precisely, we estimate next quarter's performance fees attributable to Legg Mason should range from $10 to $20 million. Additionally, we anticipate that there will be minimal, if any, pass-through performance fees at Clarion in fiscal Q3. Slide 8 highlights the acquisition and transition-related charges we incurred in fiscal Q2. It also highlights our expectations for fiscal Q3 and 4. For the quarter, the acquisition and transition-related expenses totaled $13 million. In fiscal Q3, we are anticipating acquisition and transition-related expenses of between $5 to $7 million, with an additional $2 to $3 million in fiscal Q4. And as noted in footnote 2, the current quarter includes $5 million in Entrust Primal savings, up slightly from last quarter, or $20 million on an annualized basis. And we expect a full $35 million in annual savings in fiscal 18. On slide 9, there are a couple of items to highlight. First is our GAAP effective tax rate of 26% for the quarter, which was impacted by the UK tax rate reduction and the discrete tax items I mentioned earlier. As we look at the full fiscal year, we project our GAAP rate to be 28%, which you can see in the appendix on slide 22. Our actual cash tax rate was 6% and continues to run at a substantially lower level than our historical GAAP effective tax rate. And as we look at fiscal 2017 and through the end of this decade, we anticipate our cash tax rate will stay below 10%. Our tax shield stands at $3.4 billion following the Clarion and Entrust closings, and our associated actual future cash tax savings increased by $300 million to $1.4 billion. Remember, this $300 million in incremental tax savings was 100% funded by our issuance of debt to pay for the two most recent acquisitions. So our shareholders will realize an actual cash tax benefit of $300 million over time, importantly funded by debt providers for our recent acquisitions. Finally, I want to remind you that in calculating our earnings per share, you need to add participating securities, basically unvested employee restricted stock awards, to the weighted shares outstanding, because I have noticed several people are skipping this step. And this step was not necessary in the December and March quarters because we incurred losses in both of those quarters, which would have made the impact of these shares anti-dilutive. On slide 10, you can see that our AUM decreased by $9 billion, largely due to the $25 billion in liquidity outflows. Long-term outflows were $300 million, and market appreciation and FX positively impacted our AUM by a combined $17 billion. As a percentage of AUM, fixed income is now 54% and equity 23%, up 2 and 1% respectively from last quarter. Slide 11 focuses on flows. Fixed income inflows were $2.8 billion and were led by Western, which saw both institutional and retail inflows. Equity outflows declined by 50% and totaled $1.5 billion, while alternative outflows were modestly lower at $1.6 billion. In general, the outflows reflected broad industry trends in those sectors. As shown on slide 12, our operating revenue yield decreased slightly due to mix issues with outflows at some of our higher fee equity and alternative products. This more than offset the benefit of additional revenues from Entrust and Clarion and higher average long-term AUM. Operating expenses on slide 13 decreased largely due to lower acquisition and transition related charges. Comp and benefits increased, which I will discuss on the next slide. So looking at the other line items, D&S expenses increased due to higher average long-term AUM and one additional day in the quarter. Occupancy declined by $3 million due to lower acquisition and transition-related charges. And other expenses decreased due to a reduction in deal-related costs, lower affiliate expenses, which are largely offset in compensation, and lower corporate marketing expenses. The current quarter also included a $7 million contingent consideration credit compared with an $18 million credit in the prior quarter. Turning to slide 14, comp and benefits were up $10 million, although excluding the impacts of transition-related costs, MEP charges, the Clarion performance fee pass-through, and mark-to-market on deferred comp and seed, they increased $12 million from fiscal Q2. The primary drivers of this increase were the incremental Clarion and Entrust costs, higher incentives on increased revenues, and lower non-compensation expenses at revenue share affiliates, which then get reflected as higher compensation expense at these affiliates. The latter two items, along with higher than anticipated sales-related commissions this quarter in LMGD, resulted in our compensation and benefits ratio coming in at 55%, a bit higher than our expected rate for the quarter. For next quarter, we expect the comp ratio to drop down to 52 to 54%, and for the full year, we expect the comp ratio to be in the range of 53 to 55%. Slide 15 shows our operating margin as adjusted, which increased from last quarter, reflecting lower acquisition and transition-related costs. It also reflects a full quarter of Entrust and Clarion results and higher average long-term AUM. This really demonstrates the power of operating leverage in our model. The current quarter's margin was reduced by 2.3 percentage points due to acquisition and transition-related costs. Slide 16 is a roll-forward from fiscal Q1's net income of 31 cents to this quarter's net income of 63 cents per share. Fiscal Q1 included deal costs and the Clarion MEP charge, partially offset by a contingent consideration credit and discrete tax credits. Taken together, these decreased earnings by 23 cents a share. For our fiscal second quarter, higher operating income increased earnings per share by 9 cents, reflecting higher average AUM, a full quarter of Entrust and Clarion results, and lower other operating expenses. The change in mark-to-market on our seed and corporate investments not offsetting comp, combined with the impact of share repurchases, and partially offset by higher interest expenses, increased earnings per share by 1 penny quarter over quarter. Finally, for fiscal Q2, the combination of items noted on the slide reduced earnings per share by a penny. Slide 17 is a walk from fiscal Q1 to fiscal Q2, but here we are highlighting our adjusted EBITDA, which increased from $104 million to $143 million. Q1 adjusted EBITDA was impacted by acquisition and transition-related costs, which reduced adjusted EBITDA by $42 million. Q2 adjusted EBITDA was also impacted by acquisition and transition-related costs and the interest rate swap termination charge, which combined to reduce adjusted EBITDA by $17 million. Excluding those costs, adjusted EBITDA increased by $15 million due to higher average AUM, the addition of a full quarter of Clarion and Entrust earnings, and lower other operating expenses. Our adjusted EBITDA came in below our projection by about $10 million. Roughly a third of that variance was related to lower operating income, as we had expected better flows and up markets through the end of the quarter, but markets were actually down in the second half of the quarter. Another third of the variance is related to higher non-controlling interest, and the final third was related to lower realized gains, primarily from our seed investments. Slide 18 highlights our quarterly cash position, as well as our balanced approach to capital deployment. In the upper left, you can see that we have steadily reduced our share count by 38% since March 2010. In the upper right, we've highlighted our quarterly dividend progression over that same time frame. We now have had 7 straight years of increased annual dividends, and our current dividend per share is 7x the level of our dividend back in March 2010. In total, we've returned $2.8 billion in capital to our shareholders since we began repurchasing our shares in 2010 and steadily increasing our dividends, an industry-leading rate of capital return. On the bottom left, you can see our cash position increased to $571 million from last quarter's $491 million. As a reminder, the June quarter is our low point for the fiscal year due to mid-May bonus payments. Finally, on the bottom right, you can see the mix of our $358 million in seed investments, which are deployed to generate future growth in our AUM. So with that, thank you for your time and for joining us today. Now I will turn it back to Joe.
Thanks, Pete. The forces behind our industry's disruption have been clear for some time. evolving demographics, the globalization of markets, slow economic growth, low expected returns, and a still low-rate environment, increasing global regulation, a growing pressure on the industry from both traditional and disruptive competitors, and dramatic advances in technology. This confluence of forces and the speed with which they are happening has accelerated M&A activity, facilitated aggressive pricing of selective products by certain managers, and forced dramatic model shifts at some distribution partners. Yet we believe Legg Mason is positioned to take advantage of this disruption and win over the long term, as you can see on our closing slide. We have relevant, differentiated, well-performing, and competitively priced products. Our 9 investment managers collectively represent a powerful investment capability which we can bring to clients as unique solutions in single or multiple strategy threads or through a tapestry of multi-asset class solutions that may solve even better for outcomes. Through our global distribution teams, we have the scale to build deeper partnerships geographically and across distribution channels while expanding our offerings to meet their needs across investment capabilities, vehicles, share classes, and client services. Through our recent acquisition of Financial Guard, we can now support our advisor partners in a more complementary and efficient fashion, and this new technology will also enable us to expand the delivery of our investment expertise to clients who are harder to access in a fashion very consistent with recent regulatory changes. In summary, we like how we're positioned in this period of industry disruption, and we like our chances of emerging as a winner as we continue to execute on our strategy. And with that, we will now take your questions.
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. In order to allow everyone the opportunity to ask questions, we ask that you please limit yourself to one question and one follow-up. If you have a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone phone. If you wish to be removed from the queue, please press the pound sign or the hash key. If you're using a speakerphone, you may need to pick up the handset first before pressing the numbers. One moment, please, while we poll for questions. And our first question is from William Katz from Citigroup.
Okay, thanks. Good morning, guys. Just want to come back to your opening comments about the implications of the DOL, and still hearing a similar thing from the industry, although I think you're among the few that actually argue that it go beyond the qualified account. So I was wondering if you could sort of, what's driving your thought process? Is that dialogue with the distributors? And then within that, I think you mentioned also some further pressure on margin. Just sort of wondering if you could spend a moment or two just talking through some of the drivers you see there.
As it relates, Bill, to your, I think what you're asking is why would we suggest that there's going to be an expansion of the rule? Suitability has long governed the industry as far as the SEC is concerned. So the move to something like a fiduciary standard would be a big deal. But the reality is the SEC has been working on this for some time and really struggled with it because of the fact that it is such a big deal. But now with this passage of the DOL rule, we think that it really increases pressure on the SEC to do something that potentially harmonizes or comes close to a similar standard in the non-retirement business. So we think that it's probably coming. And now it could be a little bit slower because with the election, we'll have a presumably or potentially a regime change at the SEC. But underpinning it is the fact that, they have been working on this and trying to accomplish something for a long time. And the DOL rule, in fact, will put more pressure on them to do so. I think as it relates to fees, there's just multiple factors that are going to put pressure on industry fees. I mean, certainly the DOL is one of them, but let's start with passive. I mean, given the continued repricing closer and closer to zero, of passive strategies, that just has a natural pull on active fees. And if you think about it, we're in a relatively low rate and low return world. So fees, you know, as a percentage of total returns, have the, frankly, the potential to be too high and probably are too high. So you've got passive, you've got competitors out there aggressively cutting price to try to gain share. You've got the DOL, which we know will, you know, as the distribution platforms and our distribution partners review and consolidate their platforms, they're very likely to come and look for fee concessions from those that remain. And then, you know, we do see, and I mentioned this in my opening comments, a significant uptick in our open opportunities, particularly in the equity side, but we've got also fairly significant open opportunities, what we would call sort of a pipeline, and that would be, you know, RFPs and things like that, a fairly significant pipeline of RFPs, and in some cases all the way out to finals and late stage. But what we see happening are more and more clients, particularly in the equity side, seeming to redo their allocation from perhaps entirely equity or, in any event, looking to allocate more to passive and then putting underperforming active strategies out for bid and out for reconsideration. And in so doing, we just fully expect that they're going to want to negotiate lower on fees. So I think you've just got a whole confluence of events that are going to work to drive fee rates lower. What's the magnitude of that? Can't tell you, but I think the direction is clear.
Thanks. Just to follow up, I guess the good news is if I look at the pipeline, Entrust pipeline is up a little bit sequentially, but you did suffer some pretty big outflows in the quarter, and you highlighted the industry at large. Can you sort of tease out the mix of Entrust today, where it is, and what kind of residual potential risk you have in terms of further hedge fund-related outflows and any other comfort we can get around that part of the business?
I think, Bill, you know, as we mentioned, first of all, you saw just another very significantly difficult quarter for hedge funds broadly. As I mentioned, it was the worst quarter for flows or for outflows in hedge funds since 2009. And that's really the bulk of where our outflows were. The new Entrust per mal is really more diversified with unconstrained strategies, specialized products, and those have actually held up quite well. The customized space, we're not giving up on hedge funds. We're just going through a very difficult time of high pressure in that space. When we talked to them recently, you know, there still are opportunities. They're getting at-bats for new customized mandates. They tend to be more in separate accounts than in commingled funds, but there is still demand, and it's really primarily from larger clients for customized strategies, but again, in more in separate accounts than commingled funds. Where we see a significant opportunity, and as I alluded to, they're working on a number of commingled products and specialty products really around direct lending. We haven't launched them yet, but they're in the pipeline. They feel good about the potential demand for those. It's probably, you know, just to be candid, somewhere 4 to 6 months away before we really get some visibility around that. But they feel very good about their chances for that.
And our next question is from Craig Siegenthaler from Credit Suisse.
Thanks. I was just wanted to see if you could update us on your appetite for M&A versus buyback.
Well, Craig, look, I think, you know, this is a great opportunity, and I told Alan that I wanted to be very, very clear about this. We are not really in the market at all for anything of any substantial size in terms of M&A. We are very focused on taking what we've acquired. We feel very good about what we've acquired. We feel very good about how we've expanded our investment capabilities and strategies. And so, you know, are there gaps? Yes. Do we feel any pressure or urgency around trying to fill them? No. What we feel urgency around is bringing them, what we have now, together and developing and driving organic growth with them. So I want to be very, very clear that we do not see any kind of meaningful M&A, activity on our part. We're not talking to anybody in any meaningful way right now. I will say we are working with various of our affiliates on small bolt-ons that would ultimately be wrapped up or rolled into an affiliate, or potentially, you know, again, a small acquisition in terms of technology, much as we did with Financial Guard, where we didn't even disclose the price because it was not material. But we do not see any major M&A transactions on the horizon. As far as the buyback goes, you know, we'll do what we always do, which is evaluate it versus alternatives. But right now, frankly, with where the stock's trading, that seems to be one of the best alternatives for our excess cash.
And I just had a follow-up to Bill's question on fee pressure. If you apply what you said to your business, are there any segments in Legg Mason that have risk of fee cuts in terms of getting the products more competitive? I was especially looking for any commentary on the traditional active equity business or interest promote.
No, I don't think anything unusual, nothing that's different than anybody else in the industry, right? So as it relates to the fee rates, the management fees that we charge on our equity products or our fixed income products, we constantly review those management fees from a competitive standpoint. That's not something we've just started. We've done that for a long time and over time have unilaterally or initiated fee rate cuts if we think that for whatever reason we want to make them even more competitive. But we don't see anything particularly unique or discrete to us as it relates to that. I think that the Entrust, what I would say related to Entrust Permal, I think as it relates to the customized business, right? So the traditional sort of fund-to-fund business, although, again, it's really more customized now. That's what I was trying to make the point of before, which is it's not so much fund-to-fund, but they are separate account mandates. But increasingly, those clients are moving management fee down and performance fee up. So I think you'll continue to see that. But as it relates to commingled funds, as it relates to specialty products, at Entrust Permal, and that's really a lot of the Entrust piece that we picked up. That pricing seems to be holding in quite well. I think there's really no pressure as far as we can tell, or no meaningful pressure with Clarion. So I think wherever you get kind of very unique, differentiated asset classes or products, you retain greater pricing power. Where you're in the sweet spot of something that's more commoditized, you're going to be under pressure, and we're going to be under pressure on those kind of strategies, whether it be, equities, large cap equities or fixed, but no differently than anyone else in the industry.
And our next question is from Robert Lee from KBW.
Yeah, hi, Joe. I just had actually a follow-up to the fee question. I mean, it comes up a lot in obviously all the calls this, but can you help us kind of, really kind of help us frame how you think about that pressure? I mean, there's, incremental fee changes, as you hit break points or you have to go from, 40 bips to 38, and then there's wholesale fee changes on an existing book of business, where you go from, I don't know, let's just throw out numbers, 50 to 30 or something. So, when you think of fee pressure on existing books of business, and the need to adjust it, are you thinking that, there's a risk there, there's going to be like, this kind of massive reduction in existing fees charged on funds, or is it really on the legacy books of business going to be more this kind of incrementalist, chip away maybe a little bit here or there around the edges? I mean, kind of, I know it's hard to forecast, but how do you kind of think about that playing out?
Well, I think the last thing I want to do is send a message to our customers we're anticipating massive fee cuts. I think there's going to be fee pressure. I think as our distribution partners consolidate their platforms, you're going to have products that are relevant. You're going to have products that are performing well, and then you're going to have products that are competitive from a fee perspective. And look, if they're performing well, you've got you also have a little bit more pricing power. Some of the reason that they're combining, products on their platform is because a number of products are not performing. In other cases, it's because they've got just way too many subscale products and expenses for them to continue to follow and research them. But I think, you know, there's an opportunity here too. So I want to be clear. Yes, we think the direction of fee rates are down. I don't really think anybody's disputing that. I think the opportunity for us, I don't want to kind of use live, make it up in volume, but in some respects, that can be the case. If we're taking off X number of funds that are out there in fixed income, and our fixed income fund is well positioned and well placed on the platform, is on the recommended list, we stand to gain disproportionately from that. So, you know, look, I think we all believe we're in an environment where there's going to be some pressure downward. Do I think our fee rates are going to be halved? No, I don't think so. But I do think there's going to be some negotiation around bringing those fee rates down a little bit, particularly in a low rate and low return environment. And how that all plays out, we don't know yet. It's early in the game. Price is an important consideration right now. It's performance. It's price. There's a lot of factors that come into play.
Great. That was my question. Thank you.
Sure.
Our next question is from Mac Sykes from Gabelli.
Oh, good morning, gentlemen. I have a two-part question on the flows for the industry this quarter. You mentioned the worst since 08. I guess how much impact is occurring now because of anticipating the DOL changes in April next year? I mean, are we seeing some aspects to the sales impact already in the marketplace? And then second, one of your competitors spoke yesterday about this factor from asset class preference by the rising baby boomer generation now and what will occur over the next couple of years. So I guess I'm just trying to better understand some of the degree of factors this quarter from passive competition, regulatory anticipation, and demographic changes. And I just want to hear your opinion on that.
Sure. I think that there has been some early moves as it relates to related to the DOL. I don't think it's been huge, and the reason I don't think that is that not all of our distribution partners have landed or have communicated yet. They're getting close. I mean, some obviously have. We've heard about those and they've been out. But yesterday, one of the major distribution partners sort of released their approach to how they're going to handle DOL. So there's a lot of discrepancy between how far along various of our distribution partners are in making a determination of how they intend to comply with the rule. So before they comply, they're unlikely to be moving a lot. I think a lot of their advisors are waiting to get that direction from their home offices before they start adjusting the flow. So I think there's been some. We've experienced a little bit. I think there's been some, but I don't think there's a lot of it. I think more of the flows, the negative flows, particularly in the U.S. and in, for example, large cap equity, are more related to valuations, are more related to, I've seen some surveys recently where, kind of investor sentiment for equities is fairly low right now. So I think you are seeing some people pull money out of out of equities and either move it to passive, as we've seen, or move it to fixed income. We've benefited from that a little bit. So I think it's more about just sort of normal investment behavior. It's heightened in here where investors seem not to be as enamored with where valuations are on the equity side broadly. I think clients are, investors are increasingly attuned to, returns, because all they hear about, and appropriately so, is how is my active manager performing? And if they're not performing, it's a very easy trigger to move that into passive. So, I would say, now the good news for us, along the lines of investment performance, is ours broadly improved quarter over quarter. So we feel good about that. But I think they were more kind of macro factors there. I can't tell you for sure, sort of the demographic component to it. I will say that, I mentioned in my remarks that, we are seeing increased interest in ESG. It's broader than just, I think everybody likes to just categorize it or predominantly categorize it as a millennial phenomenon. And I think it, you know, the millennials clearly, I mean, you read a lot about it, do have that element to their, you know, a focus on ESGs, on ESG investing. But it's beyond that. And, you know, we feel good about where we are. We've had something on the order of $500 million in flows in ESG just over the last two quarters. So that is a positive factor. And with ClearBridge, you know, ClearBridge has a 30-year history or thereabouts in the space. So we're a leader in that. We feel good about it. But how much of, you know, last quarter's flows were driven by a certain demographic segment, I don't think I can tell you with any precision.
And our next question is from Michael Cyprys from Morgan Stanley.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking the question. Just wanted to follow up on your point, Joe, on retail SMAs. You mentioned that you're gaining market share. I'm just curious if you could remind us how much you're managing today in the SMA space and which affiliates this is mostly with. And then just a follow-up there would be if you could just, given your affiliate structure, how are you thinking about bringing together the different strategies across your affiliates to place the model portfolios and SMAs? How much of that's done today?
Sure. So we're, you know, the move towards SMA has been a – this is one of the things that I think is interesting, particularly as it relates to the DOL. I think we – this is not an overnight shift in investor sentiment. What we've seen over the last few years is a steady increase in the percentage of our retail business in the U.S. moving towards SMAs. We've seen a steady increase, and that mirrors our clients to a certain extent. So what you've seen in the industry over the last few years is a lot of advisors increasingly moving to advisory from brokerage, and that's going to continue. That's going to accelerate as a result of DOL. So, but it's not something that's just starting, right? This move from advisory or to from brokerage to advisory has been underway. Along with that, you've seen a significant increase in our funds in iShares or IS share classes, because that's what's on the platforms for advisory business. So we've seen our iShare as a percentage of our total mutual fund business steadily increase over the last few years. Our SMA business also has steadily increased year by year by year. We are the second largest SMA provider in the business, and I'm pleased to say that through the first 6 months, we were the fastest growing SMA provider in the business. Those SMAs are done across our investment lineup, but I would say predominantly with ClearBridge and Western. And that's been a long partnership of those two firms in providing either fixed income or equity SMAs. Now, the last part of your question was around sort of multi-asset class solutions. And what we see there, I think you know this, but you know, we recently brought our affiliate CEOs together and we spent some time talking about product development, particularly around multi-asset class solutions. And it is QS that will be our affiliate that will do two things. One, will create models, and increasingly models are becoming important to the retail advisor. They're becoming important because they help to serve as a validator. Advisors increasingly, you know, with the DOL, are looking for something to kind of hang their hat on and validate the decisions they make in terms of allocation and in terms of selection or fulfillment. And so QS is the firm. And by the way, interestingly, what we're hearing is that as we get into the spring, once the DOL is enacted, that certain of the distribution partners are going to start, they're at least entertaining the notion or the idea of allowing third-party models on their platforms. And that would be good for us. That QS would be the firm that would, in fact, construct those models. And then from there, if we develop single products that are multi-asset class, it would be QS that brings those affiliates together and does the dynamic asset allocation of those. They already do that. So we have a number of products out there, predominantly in the sub-advisory space, where QS is our asset allocator for multi-asset class solutions. So that's how we see things playing out.
Great. That's it.
Michael, you dropped now.
We'll go to our next question from Michael Carrier from Bank of America.
Thanks, guys.
Hey, Pete, maybe just one for you. You know, you went through the fee rate in the quarter, and I guess when we just look at it and you look at like a full quarter, you know, of the deals, and then, you know, just what the markets did in the quarter, and then the money market outflows, you know, it seems a little unusual. So I didn't know if there was anything, you know, else there, or if there was something on timing. You know, it just seemed a little bit, you know, I was, you know, odd just given, you know, the different factors. And so just wanted to get, you know, any insight on, you know, maybe the quarter, but probably more importantly, just the outlook based on what you know, as of today.
No, sure, Michael. Thanks for the question. And you know, always remind folks to, you know, keep in mind we're playing in a very thin layer of the salami here. We're five digits to the right of the zero. But we would have expected, just as you did, you know, the normal markets, we would have been up slightly. But the reality is there were some mixed changes within the quarter, particularly Royce, and then on the alternative side, some of that was impacted by markets, some of it was impacted by flows. But bottom line is, you know, as we look out to next quarter, we see it bouncing back up in the same range that we were in the June quarter. So again, but it's heavily impacted by market and mix of affiliates.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Sure.
Our next question is from Ken Hill from Barclays.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning, Ken.
So you guys mentioned, you know, kind of this money in motion from a couple different angles, one from the Department of Labor. I think you kind of highlighted about $3 trillion, and then you also talked a little bit about how clients are increasingly moving more money more frequently between asset classes, different vehicles. So I'm just curious how you're adjusting your sales processes and maybe your strategy to kind of tap into both of those trends right now.
Well, look, on the platform side, I mean, we already enjoy pretty strong platform placement at most of the distributors. So we feel good about that with large core strategies. And so we feel good about being not just a survivor, but a bit of a thriver, if you will, with respect to that consolidation. But that requires a lot of work of our national accounts teams working very closely with our distribution partners' home offices. I think that as it relates to the institutional business, and what I was saying is just and look, this is more anecdotal than anything, but what it feels like are where we've seen some outflows, we've seen certain, you know, I mentioned, for example, Brandywine was out, and it's a tough environment for them because the global bond market, the sovereign market, is just less attractive than it has been for a while, right? So, and I think that relates to a very low yield around in the neighborhood of 65 basis points with a duration of 8 years. What Brandywine has actually seen is not people moving from global bonds, from them to another global bond manager, because their performance is actually good. What they've seen is them moving into other asset classes. We've seen the same thing at Rare. In some cases with Rare, for example, they've seen some movement out of listed infrastructure back into the unlisted or private equity infrastructure space. So what it feels like to me, and again, this is more anecdotal than anything, is that you're seeing two things. One, you're seeing people kind of toggle between asset classes when a little bit more frequently than we've seen in the past based on valuations. The second thing is I think institutional clients are, you know, taking a step back. I think they are increasing their allocations to passive, particularly in the classic active large cap type strategies. They are increasing their allocations to passive. And then they're taking the remainder that they want to leave in active, and they're reviewing the manager who's got the mandate, and they're putting it out and taking a look. Like I said, we've got more in the pipeline. Now, how much of that actually, you know, bears fruit, we don't know, and it will take time for us to understand that. But we've been very surprised by the build of the pipeline on the institutional side, and our fixed income side is, you know, more than even double that or thereabouts. So we've got a very healthy pipeline. How much of that actually comes through the pipe and gets funded, we'll see. How much we win and gets funded, we'll see.
And our next question is from Dan Fannon from Jefferies.
Thanks. Good morning. Joe, you mentioned with Western, you know, more than half are from new clients. Can you talk about just kind of maybe geographically or some of the nature of that and you know, kind of is that coming from, you know, like Mason Distribution? Is that something they're doing? You know, just a little more color there would be helpful.
Sure. Actually, I'm glad you picked up on that because that was something that we found to be a very powerful indicator at Western. We really feel like Western is well poised. That half of their unfunded wins coming from new clients was all really through not through global distribution, but through their institutional business. We have been strong and picking up share in the retail space for them as well. You know, one of the things we looked at, we were out at Western earlier this week for our board meeting, and what we noticed was we were kind of looking at a couple of things at Western, and we saw a survey by one of the institutional consultants that showed the progression of the perception of Western over the last 3 years and how positive it has become. Secondly, we decked that right against what I've talked about in previous calls, which is the progression of consultant ratings, where all but one of the top 15, I think, has a buy rating on a strategy with Western, and the one that doesn't has a hold. And then we looked at their investment performance, and their investment performance is just so strong that we really think that Western has come through this challenging period of several years since the crisis. You know, we talked about them being in the penalty box for a long period of time. They're not in the penalty box anymore, and they're getting more at-bats. They're getting more looks. They've got a significant pipeline of open opportunities. They are a significant, they're almost 50% or thereabouts of our unfunded wins. So, I mean, it's growing, you know, and they're doing a good job.
We'll go to our next question from Chris Harris from Wells Fargo.
Thanks. Hey, guys. So big M&A is kind of off the table for now. You guys are really focused on driving organic growth. You know, outside of performance at your funds, which is, you know, clearly out of your control, what few things do you think are most strategically important, and what are you most focused on as it relates to really accelerating or driving organic growth?
So, look, I think there's a couple of – first of all, thank you for reiterating what I said about not focused on any major M&A deals. I'm glad to get that out and make sure people hear that. Secondly, I think, you know, let's talk – you know, we have two segments, right? We have institutional and we have retail. On the institutional side, as I mentioned, we recently brought our affiliate CEOs together, and I think one of the things that we talked about and recognized was that there is more collective strength between and among the affiliates on the institutional side, and how can we work together to leverage that. You know, if you look across the platform at the number of clients that we have among all of our affiliates, it's really a staggering number. I don't have the exact number in front of me, but it's a substantial number. Obviously, we always honor client privacy and considerations and things like that. But the ability to make introductions and the willingness on the part of one another to begin bringing their top salespeople and client service people together to talk about best practices, talk about strategies for initiating relationships and things like that, there's a great openness to doing that. So I you know, the institutional business and whatever we can do to support and facilitate that, we also do that to a certain degree with what we call sort of complementary institutional distribution. Brandywine actually has been a great proponent and very active in that space, where they have tapped into very strategically and thoughtfully where they don't have the resources, but where our global distribution team has people on the ground who know local language, local culture, can facilitate meetings and introductions. And Brandywine's actually done that with some pretty good success. So upon hearing that, a number of our other affiliates want to tap into that kind of complementary institutional distribution, where they tap into our local retail teams to help them and to facilitate. So I think there's more to do on the institutional side. Again, we feel like Western's in a good spot and growing again, but we think across the platform we can properly and appropriately bring together our affiliates to work together in some way, shape, or form. On the retail side, it's about product development. It's about working with our distribution partners, making sure we're properly placed. It's about coming up with solutions, whether they be multi-asset class or single or multiple strategies. But I think it's really around product development. It's around ETFs, things like that. So, you know, it's being creative and listening to our clients. I'll go back to the rare UK fund that we launched right after Brexit. That was because we were listening to clients who were looking for income and yield in a differentiated way. We're getting a bit uncomfortable with the property funds over there. And so a lot of the flows that we got were people moving out of the property space and into a new asset class that can give them yield and income. So, you know, again, products and vehicles. We see a great opportunity to continue to grow our retail SMA business. We've got a number of potential launches for new ETFs of many of our existing products on the table. So we've got a lot going on with the products and vehicles, and I think that's how we grow retail.
And we'll go to our next question from Glenn Shore from Evercore ISI.
Hi, thanks. Maybe just two quick numbers questions. So, Pete, there's some moving parts in and out, and you have that good EBITDA slide, but there's a bunch of moving parts. So I think everyone likes the buyback and share count shrinkage, but there's some debt issuance also this quarter. So can you update us on where you think the right look on debt to EBITDA is right now and where paying down some of that debt falls in your priorities?
Yeah, sure, Glenn. And as you've heard us say, and particularly Joe say, you know, we're not at this moment out there looking to do anything big on the M&A front. We certainly have the ability from our current cash flow to fund anything, you know, small, tuck-in type of thing. But our primary focus, as we've said a number of times, is going to be consolidating the affiliates that we have. We see we've got a lot of opportunity to help them grow, get them connected to our retail distribution platform, and then delever. And so that, you know, at this stage we've got an agreement more or less with the rating agencies around how we're going to do that over the next 24 months. We're probably, you know, a half to three quarters turn higher on EBITDA than we'll end up once we're fully delevered. And a lot of that delevering, as you know, is going to come from growing EBITDA, which we, as you can see from that slide, you know, we're having the opportunity to do that. And as we get the interest from all saves and get hopefully some normal growth here from markets, we're very comfortable being able to get back down to what we talked to the agencies about, which is the low kind of 2X range over the course of the next 18 to 24 months.
Okay, I appreciate that. And the other one was, on the front page, you'll see revenues up 11, expenses up 15, and AUM up 9. Can you give us some look on that, excluding all the deals? Just it's just hard to see what the organic growth is.
Yeah, well, again, there's a lot of moving parts, as you know. So our total revenue's up probably about $50 million. There was 35 of that that related to, well, actually 21 of performance fees at Clarion that were passed through. That's the increase quarter over quarter. So if you went back to the June quarter, they were about 15. This quarter, they're about 36. So 21 of that growth in revenue was coming through, passed through performance fees at Clarion. And the remainder was coming through a combination of having a full quarter of Clarion and Entrust Permol. And we don't get into the EPS impact of each of our individual affiliates, as you know, but we are very comfortable with the 10 to 20 cent range for the full fiscal year. The other thing we had that is probably important understanding the numbers from an expense side, we at this stage, last quarter, had about $5 million of the saves that we expect from Entrust Permol ultimately. So $5 million in the quarter, that would be about $20 million annualized. And again, we're very confident of getting to the $35 million. We pretty much have scheduled out all the things that need to happen there in terms of headcount and real estate to get us there by the end of the year. So we'll be looking at a full $35 million in fiscal 18 in terms of saves from Entrust Permol.
Thank you. And that concludes our question and answer session. I would now like to turn the floor back over to Mr. Sullivan for closing remarks.
Thank you, operator. I want to actually answer a question that wasn't asked. And it wasn't asked last quarter, and we heard about it a little bit afterwards, and it wasn't asked today. So I was prepared to talk about October, and I'd like to give you some color around it. And make kind of three quick points. First of all, let me be clear. We expect October to be a relatively soft month in terms of flows, with outflows in the range of $1.5 to $2 billion. Specifically for the outflows, we see the following. We see $1 billion out with a large sovereign wealth fund client in a large cap equity strategy at ClearBridge. It doesn't appear to us to be performance related, as the strategy has performed and beaten the bench over the last few years net of fees. Is it oil or budget related? Is it a reallocation? I don't really know, and I can't confirm that. We do see another reallocation outflow. I sort of alluded to this at RARE, again, that we understand to be a move to private or unlisted infrastructure from listed infrastructure. We do see a platform outflow, a consolidation outflow, that candidly is a little bit performance related. Some of these platform or consolidation flows in or out are, to some degree, or it's in some respects, performance related. We did not, in this particular case, give them a reason to keep us on that. And then we do see Royce continuing to be a bit in outflow. On the positive side, fixed income continues to be in nicely, particularly at Western. While positive trends, particularly at Martin Currie and Clarion, continue, and we look to be having another solidly positive month on our global retail platform. But before we let's not end there, because I want to offer a little bit of perspective. As I mentioned a little bit in my prepared remarks and back during our mid-quarter investor lunch call, I really urge you to avoid drawing conclusions from our monthly flow release. You know, we chose to release our flow data monthly because we think it's actually better for investors and for the sell side. The risk to us in doing so is that you extrapolate one month, either positive or negative, to the entire quarter or year, and that's just a mistake. What we're seeing and what I think we all need to get used to is what we believe to be a change in the volatility in larger flows. And I think this is not just a Legg Mason phenomenon. We think, as I've alluded to earlier, this is an industry phenomenon. We're going to see larger puts and takes as our distribution partners consolidate their platforms. As I said, this phenomena impacted QS this month. And we're going to continue to see these things happen over the next several months, both in and out. And then, as we just talked about a few minutes ago, institutional clients, for whatever reason, seem to be tactically moving mandates between asset classes and different vehicles more frequently than we've seen in the past. We're going to lose some platform positions, we're going to lose some institutional movements, and we're going to win some. Last point. Just last quarter, our flows were out 500 in July, in $1.6 billion in August, out $1.4 billion in September. Extrapolating quarterly results from any of those months could have led you to the wrong conclusion. As it was, as I mentioned, it was the worst quarter for active U.S. equity flows since 08, and for hedge funds since 09. But our quarterly net outflow was $300 million against a book of $630 billion long-term AUM, virtually flat. Look, we're not celebrating outflows. We never do. But in the context of this market environment, we'll take that. All this simply reinforces why we've been relentlessly focused on diversification by asset class, by client type, by channel, and by geography. So with that, on behalf of my colleagues at Legg Mason, I appreciate you taking the time to join us this morning. We certainly feel the challenges associated with industry disruption before us each and every day, yet we see opportunities to leverage the capabilities and the platform that we have created to the benefit of clients and shareholders and emerge a winner within this industry. We appreciate your confidence in us, and we look forward to updating you on our progress next quarter. With that, have a good day.
And this concludes today's teleconference. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect your lines at this time.